Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us as we wrap up another week's worth of programs. We're also pleased to have here on the show our own chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser. Occasionally, at least a couple times on the year, we ask him to come in and talk about weather. Now, I want to make sure that people understand this is not Talk to Ed, not like we do it during Morning Edition. We cannot give you weather forecasts for places that you may travel. And the reason we can't do that is Ed is here in the studio with me. And when he does this, he does that from his office where he has all of his weather information resources that he can look at. So can't do that now. But that's a different sort of thing with this program. The idea is that if you have some question about weather forecasting, about weather and how it works, questions that might take a couple of minutes to answer, those are the questions that we welcome, because when we're doing the other thing, you like to try to talk to as many different people as possible and kind of move that thing along. And if there's something that might take a little bit of time to answer, it slows things down a little bit. So that's why we ask Ed every once in a while to come in and talk with us here on Focus 580. I'm sure that we will be talking in part about severe weather since we're headed into that time of the year. So if you have questions about thunderstorms or tornadoes, those are fine. But if you have questions about something else, that's okay too. You want to talk about summer weather, winter weather, any kind of weather, you can call us. So the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we'd be happy to take as many calls as we can. Well, thanks very much.
Good morning.
For doing this. We'll go right away. We have a caller, so we might as well go ahead and talk with them. In Bloomington, Illinois, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Wondering if you could tell me why there's a tendency for squall lines to appear ahead of cold fronts instead of behind them like you'd think they would.
Well, first off, to get a thunderstorm, you need to have an unstable atmosphere, and that means the temperature has to drop off dramatically with height. So most of the time, to get those conditions, you need very warm air near the ground. So that would be ahead of a cold front. And sometimes also storms will form right along the front where the cold air knifes into the warm air. And as that happens, then the thunderstorms produce a cool downdraft, which spreads out ahead of the thunderstorms and acts as a mini cold front for lifting the air to produce more thunderstorms. So usually you get a squall line out ahead of a cold front then. Once you get behind the cold front, with the colder air near the surface, oftentimes there's less of that instability to produce the thunderstorms.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right.
Hope
very
that helps.
Right. We'll go to somebody else here in Wellington, line number 1. Hello.
Yes. I was wondering if you could explain some of the, well, not the real, real common ones, but the fairly common symbols that one sees on a weather map, especially when I look at my computer weather. You know, I understand about highs and lows and the different symbols for the warm and cold fronts, but some of the other things, I'm kind of left wondering, well, what do these mean?
Well, this is going to be interesting because a picture is worth a thousand words. And if you could describe perhaps a couple of the symbols that you're curious about, I could probably explain them better. If you already know what the highs and lows and fronts are, which are the most common symbols you see on the weather maps, then if you could be a little more specific. I'm having trouble talking there. If you could maybe give me an idea of what kinds of symbols you're referring to, I might be able to help you better, because there are many, many meteorological symbols.
I guess I should have been jotting these down when I was looking at it a few days ago, huh?
Well,
you were coming on, I kind of can't, nothing springs to mind. Although one thing is, you know, when you look at the map about like the composite radar tops, is that a pretty good indication of a storm activity then?
Well, when you look at the composite radar tops, the higher the top, the deeper the storm. So most of the time that is indicative of the strength of the storm, although sometimes you can get a low-top storm that's pretty strong. And I assume that the maps that you look at with that have just three numbers such as 500 or 350.
I'm assuming that's in thousands feet.
That's thousands of feet. You add two zeros, exactly. Now, for other symbols, I don't know if you're talking about isobars or the lines that are drawn around highs and lows, or if you're talking more about precipitation symbols.
Well, okay, let's talk about millibars a minute.
Okay.
I understand, you know, when the lines are real close together and packed, well, that means, you know, you're having probably a lot of wind, for instance.
Exactly, because for those that don't know, isobars are lines of equal air pressure. So the closer the isobars are to each other, the bigger the change in pressure over a small area, and differences in air pressure create the wind. So,
okay, like in millibars, you know, is it what's the difference between the low ones and the high ones?
Okay, well, surface air pressure is corrected to sea level, and the average air pressure at sea level is about 1,013 millibars. So anything lower than that is a little bit on the low side, and anything above that's on the high side. So if the air pressure is below 1,000 millibars, you're probably close to a center of low pressure of some kind. And if you ever see the air pressure up around 1,050 millibars, that's a rather strong high, or rather high pressure. So the average is 1,013 at sea level, if that helps.
Well, thank you.
All right, that converts to about 29.92 inches of mercury for those that have home barometers that read with the inches scale.
Okay, hope that helps. Well, let me ask a basic question now. I just happen to have your webpage up here and have linked to one of the maps, and this is from the Weather Channel. And here we have L's. We know when we see the weather maps, there's L's and H's, and that's pretty obvious. Those are lows and
low and high pressure.
Highs.
That's the center of low barometer and the center of high barometer, and lows tend to be the centers of storms, and highs are the centers of fair weather.
And one thing that you always can remember, and maybe can tell you something about what's happening, is that the winds circulate around these two things in two different directions.
Counterclockwise around lows and clockwise around highs in the northern hemisphere.
Okay.
It's reverse in the southern hemisphere.
And I guess the reason that maybe may make some difference, because depending on what side of that you're on, it either may be pulling up air from the south of you, or on the other hand, bringing down air from the north.
Exactly. So counterclockwise around lows, clockwise around highs. If you put your back to the wind, typically low pressure will be to your left in general, and high pressure will be to your right.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, two other things here that you talked about, the isobars. These are these sort of like wavy lines that we see.
Yeah, on the Weather Channel map, they're probably drawn in white,
mm-hmm.
and they're lines of equal air pressure. That means every point along one of those lines has the same air pressure.
And the one thing, I guess, the only thing about those that I really know is when you see them and they're close together, that means it's windy.
Exactly. Because that means the air pressure change over a given area is greater. Just think, if you have, say, across from north to south across Illinois, if you have only two isobars, it's not as windy. The air pressure change isn't as much as if you have four isobars. So the closer together the isobars, that means the bigger the air pressure change over that given area, which means the wind is stronger, because differences in air pressure is what causes the wind to blow.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's one other thing I've asked you about that we have a caller and we'll get to. There is on this map, there is a line that has some sawtooth kind of things on one side, that is little triangles, and that's one color. And then on this part of the same line, there are segments that have a half circle, and they point the other direction. These two things do point to different directions. So when you see these things either with the sawtooth on them or with the semicircle on them, what does that mean?
Okay, well, those are fronts that you're describing, and the one with the sawtooth would be a cold front, and a cold front would, first of all, whether you have the sawtooth or the half circle, that is pointing in the direction the front is moving.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a blue line with sawtooths on it or triangles aiming toward you with the triangles pointing toward you, that means a cold front is coming toward you, and that is typically drawn in blue if you have colors. And the half circles are with a warm front, and a warm front is a leading edge of warmer air advancing into cold air. Cold air actually retreats for warm, allowing warm air to advance. Now, sometimes you'll have alternating red and blue with the sawtooth going one way and the half circle going the other way, and that's a stationary front. The front's not moving.
Oh, okay.
When you get that.
Which is the case with this one that I'm looking at right. I know you can't see it from where you're looking at right there.
Exactly. So if it's alternating red and blue with the symbol, with the
things pointing
on opposite
directions,
that means that the front's essentially just sitting there. It's stationary.
Okay. Well, let's go on here. Let's talk with another caller. Maybe I also should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. As if you couldn't figure it out, our guest is Ed Kieser. He's our chief meteorologist. And once in a while, he's here on the program, and we give you the opportunity to call in and ask questions about weather, either about how weather works or about how forecasters do what they do. Any and all of those kind of questions are welcome. 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go anywhere. You can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we have someone here ready to go on the campus, line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Each year, there are widely publicized predictions of how many tropical storms and hurricanes there are likely to be in the season. On
yes.
Where are those based?
Well, a variety of things, and I'm not really the expert on that. Those forecasts come from Colorado State University, and Professor William Gray is the person who heads the group that makes those predictions. And a lot of the predictions are based on the wind circulations in the tropics, and there are a variety of factors that you can look at on a larger scale that they can use to make those forecasts, and even to some extent the La Nina versus El Nino in the Pacific Ocean. And I'm sure that if you go to the Department of Meteorology or Atmospheric Sciences, I forget which they call it there, because some schools use meteorology as the department name, others Atmospheric Sciences. At Colorado State University, there will be links to that. But basically, they're looking at large-scale wind patterns. Sometimes there's a shift in the direction of some higher-level winds in the tropics, for example. That's one of the predictors, and some of that is part of what is connected with the El Nino and La Nina, but also some cycles that they can notice in the Atlantic Ocean as well. And while not perfect, they have had some skill with those forecasts, and they have predicted some active hurricane years.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we'll go again here to Champaign. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. Yes, Ed, we saw something this week that we had never seen before, and I wondered if you could help explain it. It was like either Monday or Tuesday, right at sunset, there was like a pillar of light that just went straight up from the sun. I mean, we've seen sun dogs that are more like a rainbow, but this was just like a pillar of bright light that just went straight up about the same width as the sun.
Well, you know what that's called?
What?
It's a sun pillar.
Oh.
So you described it very well, and I assume that it had the same color as the sun.
Yes, it was like vividly orangey-red. It was just gorgeous.
Well, that happens not as often as sun dogs and halos, and actually you see those more frequently when you have very, very cold air because you do need ice crystal clouds. So obviously it's still cold enough out there that we have ice crystal clouds, but the ice crystals that usually produce that effect seem to be more common when it's bitterly cold.
Mm.
I've often seen sun pillars when it's about 10 below zero out or you have a high temperature of zero, so you're really lucky to see that. And actually now I kind of remember seeing a little bit of that the other day myself. And it's caused by the reflection of sunlight off of ice crystals in the cloud. So the ice crystal, the type of cloud you had had the ice crystals oriented in such a way that collectively, because of course they're very tiny, they were acting like a mirror. And that's why the color was the same. Sun dogs and halos are actually caused by the refraction of sunlight through ice crystals, getting that prism effect. So that's why you get the different colors. But with a sun pillar, that is a That is reflection that you're seeing from...
Now, why is it then it goes straight up from the sun versus way out to the sides like that halo kind of thing? What makes it...
It has to do with the orientation of the ice crystals and the shape of the ice crystals in the cloud.
Huh.
So different types of ice crystals will do different things.
Well, it was phenomenal. We were in the car, and I came to this screeching halt. And then got home as quickly as we could to have everybody else take a look. But the sun was setting so fast that it just changed very quickly.
Well, you only see sun pillars near sunrise and sunset, so that's also why you don't see them that often. You'll never see them in the summertime because you do need the ice crystal clouds. And they're really nice to look at. I wish I had gotten a good picture of it because it's harder to find those than it is the sun dogs.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, again, thank you. I want to take a minute here, and we promise we have other callers we're going to ask you to talk just a little bit about what it is that's happening in the atmosphere this time of year, particularly that makes the time we do see a lot of volatile weather. We really haven't seen that quite yet, but I'm sure we will. We'll get to the point where we have some severe thunderstorms, we have some tornadoes, and that's just what you expect for the spring. Why?
Well, the large answer is because this is a time of year where we're in the transition between seasons. The tropics are always warm, but that warmer tropical air is starting to shift northward a bit, and so you're starting to get warm, moist air, the ability for warm, moist air to get in here. Meanwhile, to the north, it's still very, very cold. The sun rose at the North Pole just a few days ago after 6 months of darkness. So it takes a while for the northern latitudes to warm up a bit. And obviously, they never get really warm there. But the contrast in temperature from the North Pole and the tropics is much greater in winter than it is in summer. So that temperature difference creates a strong jet stream, which is one of the ingredients you need for severe weather. The other factor, as I mentioned at the top of the show, is the atmosphere needs to be unstable for thunderstorms to form. And to do that, you need a large drop in temperature as you go up in the atmosphere. And that is most easily achieved by heating the surface. And as the sun gets higher in the sky at this time of year, we are getting more solar heating at the ground level. So that helps to make the atmosphere on some days more unstable, especially if there's some cold air aloft. And that's why severe weather occurs much more frequently in the spring than in the fall, because in the fall the days are getting shorter and the sun doesn't get up near as high in the sky in October, November, so you don't get near the solar radiation. You get the jet stream going there, but you don't. All that comes together for the spring, so that's why this is the prime severe weather season.
And I suppose that's also why this business of heating up the surface and then building up instability has something to do with why it is. It seems here, at least, the time of day when you're most likely to start to see the storms develop is in 2 o'clock in the afternoon and on late in the afternoon when you had that chance for that heating to occur.
Exactly. That's why afternoon and early evening are prime time for thunderstorms. I should point out, though, we can get this stuff at any time of year with some other forcing in the atmosphere. So tornadoes can occur at any time of year, and they can occur at any time of day or night. But your prime months are from late March through June for tornadoes and the really nasty thunderstorms, and the prime time of day is afternoon into the evening.
Yeah, as I have learned, among the many things I have learned from you, the fact that tornadoes have occurred in every month of the year.
They have. And again, they can occur in the morning. Just ask Dr. Bocek.
Yeah, this past spring we had a
couple
Thursdays in a row. Yeah, the poor man was sitting here and we were doing severe weather. Well, we have other callers, and you're certainly welcome to call in if you have a weather question for our meteorologist, Ed Kieser, 333-WILO or 9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm sitting here talking to you, I'm looking at my computer terminal at the website for the Storm Prediction Center. And the display called 1300 UTC Day 1 Convective Outlook, if you're familiar with that particular one.
Yes.
And down below, there is a discussion that begins, there is a apparently slight risk of severe thunderstorms to the right of a line from 25 NNE DRT 35. Can you give me a source to interpret this? Encoded.
Well, let's see. I know Mike Sola is in the office listening. Maybe he'll surf for me because I can't on the computer right now. What all of that is that basically those are airport identifiers, and so when they figure out their risk area, they put it out in code of three-letter codes there that computers can then draw. Now, fortunately, if you can get to the SPC Storm Prediction Center website, you can also see the map already drawn for you. And when it says slight risk right of a line from all those places, it will be drawn in graphical form on that website.
No, I see that.
But for example, Champaign is CMI and Decatur is DEC and Peoria is PIA. Some of them are not exactly what you would expect. For example, Quincy is UIN. So it's basically either having a knowledge of those airport identifiers or I don't know if there, at some point I remember seeing a list somewhere off the SPC website that might have that, but I can't remember exactly where. You working with these things for many, many years, I just know them, and that's basically they used to code a lot more things. You'll notice their discussions nowadays have a little bit more text to them. They don't crop the words into a bunch of contractions like they used to, but for location identifiers, they still do use the three-letter airport codes.
Okay, I didn't realize that those were airport codes.
Well, so that might help you.
Enormously.
So you can, I mean, if you're curious about one, you might be able to, I know there's a website, and I don't remember the name of the website. I just have bookmarks of things that you can type in a three-letter code and get any airport in the country, and there's a few of them that won't work because they're now dead airports, but they still use the codes for those places. I think BDF in Northern Illinois is Bradford, but I don't know if that's an active airport anymore, but they sometimes use that in describing a place. And MMO for Marseilles is not used anymore, or it's used in those codes, but there's no weather station there anymore.
Okay, well, you answered my main question. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, very good. Thank you. We'll go on to our next caller, and that's Lafayette, line number 4.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm thinking of a severe and quite mysterious phenomenon. I've heard, if I have it right, deracial.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched more than one on radar from the Weather Channel. Extremely compact and intense systems that can travel intact across country for hours, even overnight.
Yes.
And the next day, it's still smashing along a couple hundred miles on. What are these menaces? How do they get started, and what keeps them going?
Well, what are they? They're a line of thunderstorms that gets very intense, and you have what's called a bow echo with them. That's how they look on radar, and it's at that nose of the bow as the system is traveling where the winds are strongest. And sometimes they can form in different ways, but you have to have the atmospheric set up with the wind profile and all as you go up in the atmosphere in a certain way so that it can all work out. And I'm not the best derecho expert as far as how they form yet, because that's something that's relatively new, but it's sometimes supercell thunderstorms can break apart into a derecho as well. I can think of a case back in 1998. You may recall a rather vicious tornado in Spencer, South Dakota, and there were supercell thunderstorms on a particular afternoon that then kind of bowed out, or sometimes we say sheared out, and it became just a line of thunderstorms with some very strong winds. And that did hold together, as you've noted, they sometimes do all night, and moved across Wisconsin, right across Lake Michigan, and all across the state of Michigan. And some of the strongest winds ever recorded in the state of Michigan occurred in pre-dawn hours of, I believe, a Saturday morning. Could be wrong on the date. Maybe it was a Sunday morning. It was a weekend. I think it was a Sunday morning, come to think of it, and that was due to a derecho. And here in Illinois and Indiana, we seem to get them more as we get toward the latter part of the severe weather season. I've noted them quite often in June and July. So usually you don't have the wind shear profile that you would for supercell thunderstorms. The change of wind direction with height isn't as great, but you still have quite a bit of instability so that you get big storms to form and hold together. And there's still a lot of research being done on these things, as I wouldn't say they're a new phenomenon, but they're newer as far as knowledge of them. And now that we have a better radar network, we're able to track things across the country better than even 10 years ago, even though there's been composite radars for many years. Now that they have the Doppler network in, there's a lot more data that can be collected and archived. And
these things don't seem to need the help of the sun.
No, they don't, once they're together. And not all storms need the help of the sun. If you have enough wind, if you have enough strong winds to force the storms to get going, and usually you have strong winds aloft that guide the storms along. But and another thing I've noticed for this part of the country, a lot of times they'll come out of the northwest. Now, you're in Lafayette, a little northeast of where we're located. I know for the Champaign-Urbana area, oftentimes derechos will come out of Iowa and hit our area. So perhaps northern Iowa or southern Wisconsin is where the origin place might be for one of those that would hit your area.
That sounds right. I've seen them come from the Central Plains and end up in Louisiana. How do you spell that word?
I believe, and I may be wrong on this, I think it's D-E-R and then E-C-H-O. And it's a Spanish word that's used.
Echo.
Yeah, I sometimes when I spell it out, I say derecho, but it's derecho.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mysterious and rather frightening.
Yeah, and they do occur around here a couple times a year most of the time. Obviously, like tornadoes or hurricanes or anything else, some are stronger than others.
Thank you.
Right, okay.
Thank you. A little bit past the midpoint here of this part of Focus 580. Our guest is WILL's chief meteorologist, Ed Geezer, and we're talking about weather. This is your opportunity to call in and ask questions about weather. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, save your travel weather questions for one of those segments where we do that either in the morning or the afternoon. This is an opportunity for you to ask questions about weather and how it works and about forecasters and what they do, questions that might take a couple minutes to answer, and we have plenty of time to do that. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455 to Belgium, I believe. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a maybe, I don't even know if you can answer this question. I don't know if anybody can. In the Northern Hemisphere, our weather tends to come from the west and move to the east. And it's all this notice. In the Southern Hemisphere, does it do the same sort of thing? Or does it go the opposite direction?
Well, actually, it depends on what part of each hemisphere you're in. In the middle latitudes, which is generally from about 30 to 60 north and 30 to 60 degrees south in general, the weather systems tend to move west to east, and it's called the upper air winds are called the prevailing westerlies.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the tropics, weather systems tend to move east to west. In the northern hemisphere, you have the northeast trade winds. In the southern hemisphere, you have the southeast trade winds. So that's why hurricanes often form off the coast of Africa and then move from east to west across the Atlantic Ocean toward, eventually North America. So in the tropics, the weather systems tend to move east to west, and in the middle latitudes, west to east. If you go into the polar regions, you have what's called the polar easterlies, and there again, the wind direction's reversed.
I see. So they don't have hurricanes in the southern hemisphere?
Sure, they do. They do have. They don't. You don't hear about them as often, but in Australia and even New Zealand, parts of those areas do get hurricanes.
But not in the South Atlantic, mainly in the South Pacific.
Well, you don't hear about them as much because a lot of it has to do with the water temperature as well. And it seems that in the North Atlantic, just north of the of the equator, there tends to be an area that gets really warm water-wise, and hurricanes tend to form there more often. But part of it is we just don't hear about them as much. There's not as much land in the southern hemisphere, and also there is not as much populated land in the southern hemisphere. So a lot of these storms just go undetected as well. They're detected, but you don't hear about them. They don't make the news.
And don't hurt anybody, so they don't talk about them. Huh?
They don't talk about them as much. Usually when you hear about them, they're maybe along the coast of Australia, for example. Sometimes you hear about them. But hurricanes do occur in the southern hemisphere as well as the northern hemisphere.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
But that's
good.
An interesting question. It's west-east in the middle latitudes of both hemispheres.
I did not know that.
Well, you seem to know a lot so far today.
Well,
so
I don't know.
Now you've learned something new.
I have learned something new. But, you know, I've actually have been, a lot of us, we have been paying attention to you over
you
the years.
You certainly have. I've been impressed with your knowledge so far this morning. See, you can do this show without me.
Oh, no, No way. No way. Let's go to Urbana here, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Many years ago, so a cold fusion cloud. Could you address, it was going from the north to the south, looked like a tornado, but slower moving, and it looked like it was much larger, but perhaps it was much closer. Slow moving winds. Can you address what causes that?
Could you mean a cold air funnel?
Yeah, perhaps a cold air funnel. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. A cold air funnel occurs when the atmosphere up in the middle levels is quite unstable, meaning there's a rapid drop off of temperature with height. Not unstable, but the layer of instability is not deep enough to cause thunderstorms to form, or at least tall thunderstorms that can produce true tornadoes. But sometimes you'll get a layer in the atmosphere, usually when it's rather cool for a summertime day, so that you get a layer of exceptionally cool air at middle levels, and what will happen is there's up and down motions that occur when the atmosphere is unstable, and you start to get some spinning. You might get a little funnel out of the cloud, and the way you know it's just a cold air funnel and not a bona fide tornado is bona fide tornadoes occur with thunderstorms, and these cold air funnels usually don't have thunderstorms associated with them. And also the winds they carry storms that are not very strong. As you note, we've occasionally had cold air funnels sit over the area for hours. They may move just a little bit, but you could actually sit there and watch one for several hours. So that commonly happens a few times a summer in this part of the country where cold air funnels are spotted. I think just about every year in the last several years, we've had a couple of days somewhere in central Illinois, not necessarily over your community, but they do happen, and most of the time they don't touch down, so no tornado warnings are issued. If by chance one did touch down, which on a rare occasion it can, it would officially be called a tornado because it would have rotation, and it's a rotating column of wind coming from the clouds, but it would be an F0 or weak tornado. You don't want to stand in it because it still could pick up rocks and things that could hit you and cause some problems. But most of the time, they don't touch down.
Okay. Do you have time for another question?
Sure.
Okay. Years back, also south of Urbana, so it looked like a rope in the sky was, it was just kind of moving as if someone was kind of holding on to one end and moving that rope, you know, so it was stringing or snaking around a little bit. Was that a predecessor of a tornado? The conditions were ripe, strong winds and all sorts of stuff.
Did you have a thunderstorm around?
It had been raining, too. That's right.
Well, I can't say for sure because I was not there to see it or the conditions. So I can't tell you for sure what you saw. But if there was a thunderstorm around, and especially if there were some heavy thunderstorms around, it's always possible that was a precursor to a tornado. Little rotation in the sky that came off that particular storm, but I can't verify it for sure. Mm-hmm. I guess it's sort of like a doctor can't make a diagnosis without seeing the patient entirely. So that, I could say it's a possibility that was a precursor to a tornado, which probably never got organized well enough to come to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and but sometimes in that sort of state, you do get that ropey sort of loose, you know, lariat. Somebody.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Thank you very
much. It's possible. Actually, that's one thing we learn, especially now that people have camcorders. There are so many different shapes and sizes and of tornadoes and how they form and, you know, how they evolve. And most tornadoes go through life cycles where sometimes they're very skinny and ropey and other times they're straight and fatter. And it just depends on the local wind conditions and temperature and humidity conditions. So there are a lot of possibilities out there.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to St. Joe for somebody else. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. Ed, I appreciate your attempts to educate the public. This is really super. Can you give me the formula for computing wind chill?
I don't have it off the top of my head. It's a complicated formula.
It is.
I could tell you that. I don't know. There again, if Mike is in the weather office hearing this and he happens to know where it is, he can maybe bring it in. It will be something that... that most listeners will say, what's he talking about? It's a rather complicated formula. It deals, wind chill in general is just the effects the wind have on cooling the body, how it takes heat away from your body compared to an atmosphere where there's no wind.
Yeah.
And the stronger the wind gets, the faster the rate of cooling up to a certain point, and then beyond, say, about a 40-mile-per-hour wind, there's not much additional cooling. So that's what makes the formula somewhat complicated, because it takes into account the different wind speeds and all. There is a formula, and I might add, too, because now we'll probably get questions on this, there's some controversy on the formula. Scientists are now saying they can that probably a lot of them that study this, biometeorologists, say that the wind chill formula that is currently used overestimates the wind chill or the chilling effects of the wind. So the wind chill number is probably lower than it really is. Mm. And there's talk of maybe refining that equation. Of course, then you've got to get a consensus on what that equation should be.
Yeah.
And really, when you get right down to it, each individual has their own wind chill, because it does come down to your metabolism, your body shape, your exposed skin, and all of that, too.
Yeah. Well, I live in a rural area, and I like to go for a run, and it's always a little bit of a shock. I look at the air temp. Like this morning, I looked, the air temp was around 40 degrees or so, and I got out, and I started running, and I got in the open area, and my gosh, it was cold, and I was pulling my hands in the sleeves of my jacket to keep my hands warm, and I think, my gosh, it's cold out here.
Well, I know the official wind chill was in the 20s this morning.
Yeah, I, when I came back, I heard that. I said, well, no wonder I was so doggone cold. So,
the other thing, too, if you run fast enough, you're going to add to the wind chill just by your motion.
Yeah.
Especially if you're running into the wind there. And
yeah, well, I try to plan my route so I have a crosswind and not run into it, but end that stuff enough. Well, okay, well...
Thanks for your efforts. Thanks for the call. I was talking about this with a colleague the other day who just mentioned in a sort of offhand way, why is it that we don't talk about wind chill in the summertime? And I guess my answer was, well, I'm sure it's still a factor, but it's not really an issue.
Well,
because in the summertime, if you feel a little bit cooler, you'd probably say, okay, that's a good thing.
Well, also, too, it's... your body temperature internally is about 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm. When you have a temperature of 10 and you're taking heat away, you know, that's really causing maybe your internal temperature to go down much more. And also, when we talk about wind chill, we're really concerned about the possibility of the freezing of skin as well. If you take enough heat away, that can get the temperature of your skin to below freezing quicker. So once it's above freezing, it's not as much of a factor, because you're not talking about freezing skin. And also, as you get closer to your body temperature, I don't think you can really cool it as much anyway.
Uh-huh. Okay, very good. Urbana is next, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say, Ed, that I think one of the most informative things that you do, at least for me, is that on occasions when the forecast is wrong and something different happens than what you predicted, that the next day, instead of not mentioning it or being defensive, you analyze and talk about what went wrong in the forecast and why something different happened and how it developed. And, I mean, we all know mistakes happen, and I find that kind of non-defensive analysis of what happened differently than you expected often extremely informative. And I also appreciate that whoever runs the station or sets the tone around there, if anybody runs the station, makes an atmosphere that you don't have to pretend you're always right and can talk about when things happen differently than you forecast. You understand what I'm talking
about? Yeah, exactly. And I really appreciate those comments. That's good to hear because, I do take pride in my forecasting, and people tell us that they think the forecasts on our station are more accurate than what they get other places, but they're not 100% accurate. Meteorology is still an inexact science, and I want to be right all the time. That would be great if that could happen. But I know sometimes when things go wrong, I don't try to run away from it and pretend it didn't happen, and rather sometimes talk about it. And sometimes the weather forecast is clear cut, and sometimes we're on the edge between one thing and another, and I appreciate that. And as far as the tone of the station or the climate of the station, I could tell you I could have left here years ago and probably now be making a lot more money. But what drew me to WILL in the first place was the tone set by Dan Simeone when I interviewed here. They were interviewing me, but I was interviewing them too. And I left here saying I could work for that guy. I could work for that station. And that was certainly the right decision because we do have a little more freedom to, first of all, we have more time being a public radio station. By not having commercial breaks every 2 minutes, we're able to take the time to explain things a little more and be a little more relaxed at doing that. And also, Dan and Jay Pierce, my immediate supervisor, pretty much let me do my thing, you know, and we have some creative freedom here, and that makes it a great atmosphere, and I'm really glad that that's noticed out there.
Great. Thanks, Colin.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to line number two. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hello, Ed?
Yes.
Okay, I want to ask you a question. Could you describe the differences between F1, F2, F3, and so forth, tornadoes,
sure,
and what type of history we've had with those?
Excellent question, especially going into severe weather season. You're referring to the Fujita scale for wind damage, and that was developed by a group of scientists led by Professor Ted Fujita of the University of Chicago, and he's a noted tornado researcher. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago. My thesis advisor, by the way, for my master's degree at Penn State, was a graduate student under Professor Fujita and is now the severe weather expert at the Weather Channel, Dr. Greg Forbes. So Fujita's legacy continues, I guess, there. But anyway, by looking at the damage, Professor Fujita was able to come up with a scale to determine how strong the winds were inside of the tornado. So it's a scale for the wind damage caused by a tornado because the rotary winds can vary quite greatly. And the scale essentially goes from 0 to 5. Theoretically, it goes above an F5, but we've never really seen that. And F0 has a wind speed of 40 to 72 miles per hour. F1 would be 73 to 112. F2 would be 112 to 157. F3, 158 to 206. F4, 207 to 260. And the nasty F5, 261 to 318. So about 300 mile per hour winds are the highest you get on from a tornado at ground level. Only about one tornado per year is an F5. F4 and F5 combined, only about 1% make up those violent tornadoes. That's the good news. The majority of tornadoes, about 70%, are in the F0 or F1 category. So The majority of tornadoes are what we call weak, F0 or F1, whereas only about 1% is in the violent F4 or F5 category in a given year.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right.
We'll try and get at least one more. Oaktown, or maybe they say Oakton, Indiana, line 4.
Hello.
Yes.
It's Oaktown.
Oaktown, all right.
I just like to relate an observation I made about 30 years ago in Southeast Asia, South China Sea. I saw 7 water spouts at once.
Wow.
On an aircraft carrier. Of course, the captain said everybody to keep below decks. And, you know, a farm boy can't do that. And so, and all of them were taller than the ship, which was, you know, 90-some feet from the flight deck.
Well, water spouts are cousins of tornadoes, and if they do go inland, they're called a tornado.
These are all at once around the ship, too.
Well, that's rare, but not impossible, as you note.
Sailors are good liars, but this is the truth this time.
Well, I've seen video of 6 or 7 funnels at one time from a tornado on rare occasion, too, so that happens.
Okay, that's all I have.
Well,
thank you. Let's go to Urbana here, line number 3. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a question, but I would like to quickly tell about a private tornado I had and wonder if I had ever heard of such a thing. I was working with 4x8 sheets of corrugated aluminum about 30 years ago in Urbana. Nice summer day, bright sunny. And all of a sudden, the sky turned dark instead of sunny. And I noticed trees and across the street, as thick as my forearm, were suddenly blown parallel to the ground. And a couple of sheets of aluminum from my stack of them went flying around the neighborhood. One of them sliced off a tree about the size of my wrist, right level with the grass. I was wearing thong sandals and had a 4x8 sheet of aluminum in my hand, and I felt myself picked up by the wind and neatly turned around facing north, but my thong sandals remained facing south. And I saw that I could be killed with those things flying around. So I ran in the house and closed the doors and windows. And by the time I got the doors and windows closed, the sun was out again and it was quiet. And eerily, nobody was around. I think nobody saw that little wind event except myself. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
Well, I don't know if there were thunderstorms around or not. You say the sky got dark. Chances are it was just a burst of strong wind that made, probably not a tornado, but it could have been a downburst, perhaps, especially if all the trees that you talk about fell in one direction. But certainly things like that can happen. Likely if it was a tornado, there would have been more of a twisted damage pattern. And again, usually tornadoes come with thunderstorms.
My apologies to the caller for kind of jumping in, but I'm afraid we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. I'm sure, though, on another day, Ed will come back and we'll do it some more. And then later on this afternoon, we will do that thing where if people are traveling, they can get a forecast on the afternoon magazine.
Mike Sola is doing that. Talk to Mike. I just want to quickly mention a couple things coming up next week on Thursday, March 29th. On the afternoon magazine during the 1 o'clock hour, I'll actually be sitting in Celeste Quinn's chair as the host, and we'll be interviewing Ron Holly, a lightning expert. So if you have any questions on lightning, that'll be the time to ask them because he knows a lot about lightning. And then the following week on Tuesday, April 3rd, I'll have my annual tornado safety show. This year it'll be at the Beckman Institute at 7 p.m. Tuesday, April 3rd, and of course it's free. And we'll have another show on Thursday, April 5th in Normal at Schrader Hall on the Illinois State University campus. And for more details, you can call the station or check out our website, will.uiuc.edu.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
Okay.
Our own chief meteorologist, Ed Keezer.